Since the 1970s, cities around the country have experimented with choice programs, providing observers with the chance to assess the actual effects of such programs. The evidence suggests that while choice programs are hardly a panacea, they can indeed improve student performance. Carolyn Huxby, a leading economist who has analyzed both voucher and charter school programs, finds that when facing competition, public schools produce higher student achievement per dollar spent. Test score improvements can range from 1 to 7% a year depending on the school and student, and improvement is usually greatest among younger students, low-income students, and minority group members. Even though the results suggest that school choice can and does help, we believe that the results could be significantly enhanced by helping parents make better choices on behalf of their children. Many parents simply do not make use of their options and instead just send their child to the default school, usually, but not always, their neighborhood school. And those who do make choices are sometimes ill-prepared to make good ones. Because we approve of more choice, we want to focus on one important part of the school choice issue: how to create plans that put parents in a position to make sensible decisions for their children. Complex choices and mental shortcuts. Consider the revealing case of Worcester, Massachusetts. President Bush signed the federal No Child Left Behind law in 2001 with the goal of increasing public school accountability by mandating certain testing standards. We put to one side the many controversial questions raised by that law. By June 2003, 12 of Worcester's 50 public schools had been labeled in need of improvement for 2 consecutive years and 5 for 3 consecutive years. That summer, 4,700 students, almost one-fifth of the district's student population, were eligible to transfer, and 1,800 students had the right to collect federal money for supplemental education services. But 6 months later, only one student had switched schools, and only 2 had taken advantage of supplemental services. Worcester officials themselves were primarily responsible. True, the school system notified parents at underperforming schools about their rights under No Child Left Behind, but it also engaged in what the political scientist William Howe calls friendly discouragement, making parents reluctant to exercise their right to choose. The school system qualified its language about the meaning of underperforming, stressed the limitations of the No Child Left Behind evaluation criteria, and highlighted unattractive parts of No Child Left Behind, noting that space limitations might not permit transfers to be processed. The school system also explained that it was trying to improve. For the undeterred, exercising choice was a tedious, multi-stage process. First, parents had to meet with their school's principal. Few did. Next, they had to attend another meeting at a school information center. The center's director said that 2 parents expressed interest in such a meeting. At these meetings, district officials again stressed that transfers were not always possible and that there were no guarantees about transportation or school location. And all of that was before parents had to file the transfer paperwork. Even worse, because the school district controlled access to information, tutoring service, and test prep companies could not reach students without the district's blessing. The companies essentially depended on positive comments from the school district. As with a 401k plan, the average parents know little about their child's school, let alone all the other schools that are available. They might well stick with the status quo or ultimately make poor decisions. The trick is to promote actual freedom, not just by giving people lots of choices, though that can help, but also by putting people in a good position to choose what would be best for their children. Consider a few details. When parents pick schools, status quo bias plays a big role. The neighborhood school that one knows, failing or not, may be preferable to the unknown school half an hour away. In any case, the Byzantine nature of collecting and distributing school data makes it difficult for parents to think through their options. In Charlotte, North Carolina, for instance, parents receive a 100-page booklet with descriptions of 190 schools written by representatives of the schools themselves, emphasizing each school's positive features. The booklet does not include information on physical locations, test scores, attendance rates, and racial composition. These are available only on the district website. Meanwhile, staff members at a special district-wide application center are instructed to respond to questions like, which school is the best school, by saying that a good school depends on each individual child, and advising parents to talk to their children about what their needs are and to visit the various schools in order to determine which is best for their children. Although this advice is unobjectionable, it is about as helpful as when a waiter responds to an inquiry about what is good by saying, everything. A creative experiment in Charlotte shows that choices can be improved with better and simpler information. Charlotte gave parents the option to apply for admission at multiple public schools besides their default school. Low-income parents tended to put less weight than high-income parents on school quality, as measured by test scores, and rarely tried to enroll in higher-performing schools. A random sample of parents was selected to receive an abbreviated fact sheet about the schools, much in the spirit of the recap idea that we have suggested in other areas. Printed on each sheet was a complete listing of average test scores and acceptance rates, from highest to lowest, at schools available to a given child. The experimenters wanted to find out whether parents, and especially low-income parents, would choose better schools. They did. Much better ones. The parents who received the fact sheets made decisions implying that the weight they assigned to school quality, as measured by test scores, had doubled. The schools they selected had, on average, 70% higher test scores than the scores at their neighborhood schools. This had the effect of making their choices similar to those of families whose incomes were $65,000 a year higher. Furthermore, when children are lucky enough to switch to better schools, their performance improves considerably. The students who are lucky enough to win the lotteries held to decide who gets to attend the popular better schools are less likely to be suspended and have higher test scores than the students who lost. Incentive conflicts and matching. A good choice architect can do more than help parents achieve what is already in their own self-interest. The architect can also help reduce latent incentive conflicts between advantaged and disadvantaged parents during the choice process. Despite the attention they receive in the media, market-based programs like vouchers are available to relatively few students nationwide. One popular alternative is a policy known as controlled choice, which emerged in the wake of 1970s court rulings prohibiting busing for the purpose of achieving desegregation. The idea was to continue integration by guaranteeing students a priority space at a nearby school or a school that a sibling attended, while giving them the option to apply for enrollment somewhere else. School administrators in Boston adopted a computer algorithm designed to assign as many students as possible to their first-choice schools, while still giving priority to the neighborhood students. It is hard to know exactly how many districts use the so-called Boston system, because administrators do not always explain controlled choice policies in detail, but some of the larger metropolitan districts that employ that algorithm or something similar include Denver, Tampa, Minneapolis, Louisville, and Seattle. If two students applied to a school with one open seat, Seattle and Louisville broke the tie on the basis of race, a practice the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional in 2007. Matching as many first choices as possible sounds sensible enough, except for one problem. Picking schools in the Boston system turns out to be a complex game of strategy, with the winners reaping the spoils. How do the winners win? They lie, a little. Economists call it strategic misrepresentation. There is a mathematical, and complicated, reason why lying is a good strategy in the Boston system, but to get an intuitive feel, imagine that college admissions suddenly operated on a national controlled choice system. Schools like Harvard and Stanford would be heavily overdemanded, and locals would get preferential treatment. You would have only slightly better odds of getting into one than of winning the Powerball jackpot. You think property in Cambridge and Palo Alto is expensive now? What if living there guaranteed your child a seat at Harvard or Stanford? Clever parents who do not happen to live in Cambridge, but have been dreaming of sending their child to Harvard since the diaper days, would realize the futility of listing it first. The Boston system attempts to match as many first choices as possible. So if every honest parent in America listed Harvard first, only Cambridge residents would sleep well at night. Instead of taking their chances on a long shot, parents outside Cambridge would be better served to select as their first choice a slightly less popular school such as Dartmouth or Cornell, say, where there are also fewer students nearby getting preferential treatment. In the Boston system, parents who rank a school second or third lose out to everyone who ranks it first, making it risky to use a first choice on a highly sought-after school if a child has a low priority, and a complete waste to list such a school as a second choice. Information about school demand is usually available online, giving parents an incentive to tweak rankings based on acceptance rates and where their child has priority. When the Boston system was first developed, almost no one intuited this strategy. Only a handful of people even knew how the algorithm worked. But over time, some parents figured out ways to gain an edge. Not surprisingly, affluent, educated parents with large social networks, they volunteer at school with other affluent, educated parents, learned the tricks first. They performed better than less affluent, less educated parents who routinely listed an over-demanded school as a second choice, the worst mistake they could make. Who knows how many of their children lost out on access to first-rate educations because of it. The Boston system is still in place around the country, though not in Boston. In 2003, a group of economists led by Al Roth at Harvard pointed out these problems to initially skeptical Boston school administrators. After letting the economists poke around in the internal data, the administrators became convinced of their system's flaws. In response, they adopted the economists' new strategy-proof choice mechanism based on one used to match hospitals and medical residents. The mechanism does not penalize parents who are unsophisticated about the choice process, allowing them to spend time visiting schools and seeing teachers rather than estimating the level of competition to get into each school. In return, administrators do not have to guess about parents' true preferences so that the policy can be adjusted properly based on future feedback. Nudging high schoolers toward college. Good choice architecture doesn't need to originate with a wonkish professor and a powerful computer algorithm. It can be the brainchild of a local school official or two. In San Marcos, Texas, the school superintendent and an administrator at nearby Austin Community College were looking for a way to get more of San Marcos' largely Latino student population into college. They hit on a nudge so simple and effective it spread through the state faster than a YouTube clip. Well, maybe not that fast. The nudge was this. In order to graduate from San Marcos High, a student would have to complete an application to nearby Austin Community College. Because all it takes to get admitted to the community college is a high school degree and a record of having taken a standardized test, completing the application properly was tantamount to acceptance. In San Marcos, schools run on a tight budget, and two-thirds of high schoolers never experience higher education. The superintendent had no outside funding to implement the idea, so she asked her teachers and the community college for help. Students were pulled from English classes to meet with the college's staff counselors. In a smart piece of mapping, the counselors didn't try to sell the students on the high-mindedness of education. Instead, they hooked them with the universal symbol of teenage freedom, the automobile. They talked about how much more money college students earned compared with high school graduates, explaining it as the difference between a Mercedes and a Kia. Next, community college administrators took a standardized admissions exam to the high school and tested the students free of charge. The administrators also gave students financial aid information and had tax consultants offer weekend sessions for parents. In the end, the nudge produced big results. From 2004 to 2005, the percentage of San Marcos High students who went to Texas colleges rose 11 percentage points to 45%. Now more than 45 Texas high schools have similar programs, and schools in Florida and California have created programs modeled after San Marcos's. In Maine, a state legislator is proposing a law requiring high school seniors to submit at least one college application before they graduate. We have covered a lot of territory in a short space. Milton Friedman was right. At least in the abstract, school choice is an excellent idea, because it increases freedom and offers real promise for improving education. Of course, reforms should be assessed empirically, not in the abstract. Fortunately, existing evidence suggests that school choice has considerable promise. The major problem, and our principal concern here, is that what is true for investments and prescription drugs is true for education as well. It is not enough to make lots of choices available and then hope parents choose wisely. School systems need to put parents in a position to think through their choices and to exercise their freedom rather than to rely on the default option. Both parents and children need the right incentives. FDR's right to a good education is not part of the Constitution, but it has become a cultural commitment, and a few simple steps could enable many more children to enjoy that right. Chapter 14. Should patients be forced to buy lottery tickets? Every election cycle, presidential contenders unveil plans to make health care coverage available to the tens of millions of Americans who lack health insurance. The candidates decry our government's failure, thus far, to implement an effective plan. Whatever happens in the long run, such plans are hard to design for a simple reason. Health care is really expensive. It is expensive in part because Americans want access to all the best services, doctors, hospitals, prescription drugs, medical devices, and nursing homes, to name a few. Of course, we can try to keep health care affordable on our own by maintaining healthy lifestyles and by buying only the health care products and services that we need. We can save money by visiting the doctor no more often than necessary, and if we purchase insurance, we can choose a plan that covers only catastrophic illnesses instead of coverage with low deductibles, which is much more expensive. But there is something that every healthcare customer in America is forced to buy, whether she wants it or not. The right to sue the doctor for negligence. Our principal claim here is that patients and doctors should be free to make their own agreements about that right. If patients want to waive the right to sue, they should be allowed to do exactly that. This increase in freedom is likely to help doctors and patients alike, and to make a valuable, even if modest, contribution to the healthcare problem. It may seem strange to think that we purchase the right to sue. Of course, that right is not an itemized portion of the insurance bill, but it is clearly included in the price. Compare buying health care with the purchase of collision insurance on your car. The rate you pay depends on the deductible you choose. If you elect a small deductible, such as $100, you will pay a much higher rate than if you pick a large deductible, such as $1,000. Hint. Always take the largest deductible you can. It will save you a lot of money over the long run. Or consider a parcel carrier such as Federal Express, which allows you to pay more for a higher liability limit on goods that you ship. The same principle applies. The more the company would have to pay you if it loses or drops your package, the more the company charges you up front. But in the case of health insurance, and many other domains of life, alas, it is not possible to buy the insurance a la carte, with reduced rights to sue people if they mess up. If it still seems strange to think that we purchase the right to sue, consider a simple fact. Customers of many businesses face higher prices simply because they retain the right to sue those businesses. The great economist George Stigler once wrote an amusingly evil essay about an imaginary world in which students had the right to sue professors who taught them something that turned out to be wrong. The essay was called A Sketch of the History of Truth in Teaching. Professors shudder at the thought, but just imagine how much more expensive education would be today if universities and their employees had to carry mal-teaching insurance. In Stigler's fable, the branch of economics dealing with how to enrich a new nation, economic development was the title, was actually forbidden by courts on the ground that no university could pay for the damage its teachers did. Not only would education be more expensive, it would also be less effective because professors would be afraid to take any risks, for fear of being sued. We suspect that many universities and students would, if they could, contract their way out of the mess Stigler dreamed up and agree to have education without the right to sue for bad teaching. Similarly, many patients and healthcare providers would gladly enter an arrangement to eliminate the right to sue for negligence. In return for a waiver of that right, a doctor, hospital, or insurance carrier could offer a patient a lower price for health care. Some patients would choose to take the lower price and assume the risk themselves. Others would offer to waive medical malpractice liability and instead buy private disability or injury insurance. But these arrangements aren't available to patients because courts have long held that waivers of medical malpractice liability are unenforceable as against public policy. These rulings are the opposite of libertarian. They deny people the freedom to make contracts as they see fit. For patients, these legal rulings might sound great, a nice form of protection, and we will soon return to the question of protection. For the moment, just notice that it isn't always to your advantage to be forced to buy the right to sue. Suppose, for example, that people had the right to sue their hairdressers if a haircut went badly wrong, and that the cost of this insurance raised the price of haircuts by $50 after someone who had received a particularly gruesome haircut won a $17 million judgment. Would you be interested in saving $50 per haircut by giving up the right to sue if you got a bad one? Would you be angry if you were prevented from doing so? We know, the analogy isn't perfect, but consider this fact. Both healthcare customers and taxpayers are now forced to help pay for the 85,000 medical malpractice lawsuits that are filed each year. These lawsuits cost a lot of money. Estimates range from $11 billion to $29 billion per year. Exposure to medical malpractice liability has been estimated to account for 5 to 9% of hospital expenditures, which means that litigation costs are a contributor to the expense of the healthcare system. Of course, these particular figures are controversial and may be exaggerated, but no one doubts that many billions of dollars must be paid each year to buy insurance and to fend off liability. Many doctors must pay $100,000 or significantly more in insurance bills every year. Your medical bill reflects those costs. The full costs of litigation actually include much more than judgments that are paid to plaintiffs and the cost of litigation, the direct costs. There are indirect costs as well, and patients must bear those costs too. For example, many doctors practice defensive medicine, ordering expensive but unnecessary treatments for patients, or refusing to provide risky but beneficial treatments, simply in order to avoid liability. Another indirect cost of liability, and an especially bad one, is that error reporting in hospitals and among physicians is discouraged. At first glance, it might seem clear that patients benefit from the resulting system. If patients are asked to waive their right to sue, won't they be worse off? Won't they lose something important and gain nothing in return? The answers depend on what would happen in the no right to sue scenario. As we will soon see, it is not clear that patients gain a lot from the right to sue. At the same time, part of the current cost is passed on to patients in the form of higher bills, and defense medicine can be bad medicine for those who want good care. Some patients might well want to avoid paying a share of a provider's liability costs, but, and this is the key point, courts will block any deal between patients and providers that exchanges lower-cost treatment for a waiver of the patient's right to sue. Why do courts block such deals? The answer is non-libertarian paternalism, pure and simple. Courts appear to think that sensible patients would not waive their right to sue, and that doctors should not be treating patients without the threat of malpractice liability to deter negligent treatment. We are glad to acknowledge that patients are human and may make bad decisions. But we wonder whether mandates and bans are sensible in this context, and whether freedom of contract, alongside a few nudges, might not be better. One reason to allow patients the option of giving up the right to sue is that the deterrent effect of tort liability is overstated. Medical liability insurance tends not to be experience rated, which means, in less technical language, that a doctor will pay the same premium no matter how many times he has been sued for malpractice. Of course, any doctor would like to avoid the ordeal and embarrassment of a malpractice lawsuit, but she generally need not fear the financial burden imposed by one. So there is little reason to think that the financial risk of malpractice lawsuits is an important factor in getting doctors to perform better. The deterrence argument is also undermined by the stunningly poor fit between malpractice claims and injuries caused by medical negligence. To put it bluntly, most patients don't sue even if their doctor has been negligent, and many of those who do sue and end up with favorable settlements don't deserve the money. One study found that fewer than 2% of patients injured by negligence at a New York hospital over the course of a year filed a malpractice claim. Of the claims that were filed, expert reviewers found that there was no evidence of negligence, or even injury, in many of the suits that resulted in payouts to plaintiffs. But in many cases where a plaintiff lost, the reviewers found that negligence had caused the injury. In short, most patients who are harmed by medical malpractice do not get any compensation, and many patients who do receive compensation were not harmed at all or were not treated negligently. Other studies find little evidence that our current system provides significant deterrence against medical negligence. It is probably true that at least a few doctors are more careful because of the threat of being sued, but on balance, there is no reliable evidence that the threat is doing a lot of good. Consider a small but relevant fact. One factor that influences a patient's decision to sue is whether the doctor apologized for the mishap and admitted fault. If an apology prevents a lawsuit, then the deterrent effect of the right to sue is further reduced. We are not arguing that the law should stop making doctors pay for their negligence, but we do think that informed patients should be free to contract as they wish, and that many informed patients might want to waive liability in order to get a better deal. If enough money is offered, surely it will make sense to waive. Consider the fact that even if a patient does sue and wins, he'll only get a fraction of the award. About 40% ends up with lawyers. Fortunately, few of us are going to be treated negligently, and few of those who are will end up suing. If you can save something by waiving your right to sue, you might well elect to do that. The point is especially important for people without a lot of money. Since it is impossible to buy medical treatment without implicitly buying the right to sue, sick people who can afford treatment but not the package of treatment plus suit option will drop out of the market. So even if the risk of liability for negligence actually does reduce the frequency of injuries caused by doctors, these gains could easily be offset by the losses of those who are unable to afford a treatment at all. Another problem with the current system is that jury awards for the pain and suffering that may be associated with a medical malpractice claim are highly erratic. It is difficult to predict, from the facts of the case, whether a plaintiff will get a lot or a little. In medical malpractice cases, people are sometimes awarded punitive damages too, in order to punish the wrongdoer. But punitive damage awards also have a lot of variability. So patients are effectively forced to buy a kind of lottery ticket, one that might be worth anything from millions of dollars to nothing, but that is, on average, worth no more than 60 cents for every dollar spent. The rest is going to lawyers. Playing the lottery can be fun, but should people really be required to do it? Choice architects should be willing to recognize that many people would be better off if they were given the freedom to waive liability. This group doesn't include only those who would otherwise be unable to purchase treatment. It also includes anyone who purchases health care and would prefer cash instead of the right to sue. In fact, we think that negligence liability is probably a losing deal for lots of people. Paying for the right to sue includes a subsidy for administrative expenses of the malpractice litigation system, as well as awards and lawyers' fees for meritless suits. Of course, it is natural to worry that patients will, in a sense, be forced to waive their rights, to do so for essentially nothing, because that's what healthcare providers want. But usually markets don't work like that. Recall that the more insurance you buy, the more you pay, and the right to sue is a form of insurance. So long as there is competition, patients will have to get something for relinquishing their rights. We are confident that if the proposal we are making were adopted, we would both elect to waive the right to sue, and that many of the finest healthcare providers would offer that option at a real discount. So what do we propose? Our most modest suggestion is that choice architects give serious consideration to allowing freedom of contract in the context of negligence in medical care, with the thought that a libertarian approach might well help patients and doctors alike. Of course, we are libertarian paternalists, not libertarians full stop. We recognize that patients might find it hard to understand the nature of medical malpractice liability and the consequences of waiver. Waiving liability should not be done lightly or impulsively. In other domains, this view is reflected in state law, which often requires waivers to be accompanied by procedural safeguards designed to ensure that the waiving party is fully informed. Waivers generally must be in writing and must state precisely what is being waived. Most important, courts are usually unwilling to enforce waivers that are hidden in small print in long contracts. We propose, then, that health insurance companies be permitted to offer plans with and without the rights to sue for negligence. Since most health insurance is purchased through employers, we hope that employers would help their employees make informed choices. Of course, we know that framing the default would matter a great deal. If waiving the right to sue were the default, and retaining it would cost extra, most patients would probably waive. Recall that the default option usually sticks. For those that are especially skeptical of malpractice lawsuits, we have an even more ambitious proposal. Patients should be presumed to be permitted to sue only for intentional or reckless wrongdoing, and not for mere negligence. Negligence is normally defined as the failure to meet what is called the ordinary standard of care, a vague concept that tends to make lawyers fight and judges scratch their heads. Intentional or reckless wrongdoing is a harder standard for plaintiffs to meet. Under this approach, patients would be offered a right to buy a stronger liability right, but it would cost them a bit. This approach would undoubtedly mean that waivers would be common. The offer to buy should be accompanied by relevant information so that people know what they are effectively losing if they fail to accept that offer. The general point is that if fully informed, some people would purchase a kind of insurance in the form of a right to sue, but many others would prefer to take their chances. Waiver of the right to sue is just one way that doctors and patients can benefit from freedom of contract. Many states have taken steps to reduce the costs of malpractice cases. For example, California limits recoveries by capping non-economic damages, such as those for pain and suffering. We can imagine accomplishing the same goals not through law but through free agreements, allowing patients and policyholders to agree to limit liability for non-economic damages to an amount specified in the contract. Some countries, such as New Zealand, Denmark, Sweden, and Finland, have adopted an administrative no-fault system that is also used in the American Workers' Compensation System. These nations provide scheduled payouts for predefined medical injuries regardless of whether they are caused by negligence. An approach of this kind should dramatically reduce administrative burdens from an often laborious litigation process designed to figure out exactly how much patients should be awarded for their injuries. In our view, state lawmakers should think seriously about increasing freedom of contract in the domain of medical malpractice, if only to see whether such experiments would reduce the cost of healthcare without decreasing its quality. Increasing contractual freedom won't solve the healthcare crisis, but it might help. And in this domain, every little bit of help counts. Chapter 15, Privatizing Marriage. We are hoping that the idea of libertarian paternalism will offer some new ways of thinking about many old problems. We now turn to the very old institution of marriage and explore some of the questions that have recently been raised about marriage and same-sex relationships. We begin by offering a proposal that is highly libertarian, that would protect freedom, including religious freedom, and that should, in principle, prove acceptable to all sides. We recognize that many people, including members of many religious groups, strongly object to same-sex marriage. Religious organizations insist on their right to decide for themselves which unions they are willing to recognize, with attention to gender, religion, age, and other factors. We also know that many members of same-sex couples want to make lasting commitments to one another. To respect the liberty of religious groups while protecting individual freedom in general, we propose that marriage, as such, should be completely privatized. Under our proposal, the word marriage would no longer appear in any laws, and marriage licenses would no longer be offered or recognized by any level of government. The state would do its business, while religious organizations would do theirs. We would eliminate the ambiguity created by the fact that the word marriage now refers to an official, legal, status, and to a religious one. Under our approach, the only legal status states would confer on couples would be a civil union, which would be a domestic partnership agreement between any two people. marriages would be strictly private matters performed by religious and other private organizations. Within broad limits, marriage-granting organizations would be free to choose whatever rules they like for a marriage conducted under their auspices. So, for example, a church could decide that it would marry only members of that church, and a scuba diving club could decide that it would restrict its ceremonies to certified divers. Instead of channeling every partnership into the same one-size-fits-all arrangement of state marriage, couples could choose the marriage-granting organization that best suits their needs and desires. Government would not be asked to endorse any particular relationships by conferring on them the term marriage. We spell out the details of how this would work below. We then turn to the question of choice architecture. Using the principles that have helped us analyze savings policies and other aspects of life, we ask, how can the state design good rules to govern contractual arrangements between domestic partners, who will sometimes also be husband and wife as a result of a private ceremony? What is a marriage? As a matter of law, marriage is no more and no less than an official status created by the state and accompanied by government entitlements and mandates. When you are married, you get many material benefits, economic and non-economic. State law varies, but these benefits fall into six major categories. 1. Tax benefits and burdens. The tax system offers big rewards to many couples as a result of marriage. At least if one spouse earns a great deal more than the other. There can be a big marriage penalty if both spouses earn substantial incomes. 2. Entitlements. Federal law benefits married couples through a number of entitlement programs. Under the Family and Medical Leave Act, for example, an employer must allow unpaid leave to a worker who seeks to care for a spouse. It need not do so for partners. State laws often grant similar advantages to members of married couples. 3. Inheritance and other death benefits. A member of a married couple obtains a number of benefits at the time of death. A husband or wife can give his or her entire estate to the spouse without incurring any state taxes. 4. Ownership benefits. Under both state and federal law, spouses may have automatic ownership rights that mere partners lack. In community property states, people have automatic rights to the holdings of their spouses, and they cannot contract around the legal rules. 5. Surrogate decision-making. Members of a married couple are given the right to make surrogate decisions of various sorts in the event of the other's incapacitation. When an emergency arises, a spouse is permitted to make judgments on behalf of an incapacitated husband or wife. Partners are far less likely to obtain these benefits. 6. Evidentiary privileges. Federal courts and a number of state courts recognize marital privileges, including a right to keep marital communications confidential and to exclude adverse spousal testimony. To say the least, this is an immense and diverse set of benefits, and we have by no means listed them all. The benefits also tend to be fairly stable over time. Recall that the status quo is powerful, and there are sharp political constraints on any effort to rethink it. But economic and material benefits of this kind hardly exhaust the meaning of marriage. Crucially, the state explicitly links these material rights and obligations to the symbolic and expressive benefits associated with the status of marriage. For many people, perhaps most, these symbolic and expressive benefits are much of what it means to be married. So long as the state grants marriage licenses, the status of official marriage, that is, marriage that carries with it a legal status, has immense importance. A couple that is married within a religious or other private tradition, but not with the authority of the state, lacks an important kind of validation regardless of the strength of that couple's private commitment or the importance to them of the religious element of their marriage. To see the importance of the state license, suppose that interracial couples were told that they could have access to all of the material benefits of marriage, but that they would be in a status called civil union rather than marriage. Exclusion from the institution of marriage, from the official status, would itself be an offense to interracial couples. In fact, it would be unconstitutional. The state cannot tell members of such couples that they receive material benefits but are not allowed to enter the legal institution of marriage. For interracial couples, it would not matter if their marriages were supported and validated by private organizations. In sum, when people marry, they receive not only material benefits, but also a kind of official legitimacy, a stamp of approval, from the state. Without state licenses. We can now see that insofar as it operates through the government, marriage is an official licensing scheme, and that when the state grants marriage licenses, it gives both material and symbolic benefits to the couples it recognizes. But why combine these two functions? And what is added by official use of the word marriage? Compare marriages with other kinds of partnerships. When we decided to write this book together, we had to make a set of agreements. We jointly signed a contract with our publisher, agreeing how to divide the royalty payments we would receive if anyone chose to buy the book, and we made numerous other informal agreements about how we would write the book. The legal system will protect us through copyright laws if someone tries to republish our prose. It would also provide some rules if we had gotten into a dispute leading one of us to quit the project in disgust before the book was done. However, nothing in the legal system says that we must or must not swear a solemn oath to be best friends, to eat lunch together at least once a week, but no more than twice, or to forswear other collaborations. Book writing need not be monogamous. But even when our agreements are informal and not backed by legal sanction, we take them seriously and will in all likelihood abide by them. Insofar as the state is concerned, why not handle domestic partnerships like any other business partnerships? Why not privatize? State control of marriage is anachronistic. Our basic claim here is that state-run marriage makes it impossible to protect the freedom of religious organizations to proceed as they see fit while also safeguarding the freedom of couples to make the commitments they seek without being treated as second-class citizens by the state. But we also believe that the official licensing system no longer fits modern reality. For one thing, the institution of state-run marriage has a highly discriminatory past, enmeshed as it has been in both sexual and racial inequality. This past cannot be entirely severed from the current version of the institution of marriage. Insofar as it operated through government, the marital institution was originally a means of government licensing of both sexual activities and child rearing. If you wanted to have sex or to have children, you were in a much better position if you had a license from the state. In fact, you might well have needed that license no less than you now need a license to drive. A state license has a way of ensuring that sexual activity would not be a crime, and it was difficult to adopt children outside of the marital relationship. But official marriage no longer has this role. Indeed, people now have a constitutional right to have sexual relationships even if they are not married, and people become parents, including adoptive parents, without the benefit of marriage. Now that marriage is not a legal precondition for having either sex or children, the state's licensing role seems less important. As a matter of history, a primary reason for the official institution of marriage has been not to limit entry but to police exit, to make it difficult for people to abandon their commitments to one another. Of course, there are good reasons for this form of policing, which can operate as a nudge or as much more. Marriage might seem, in part, as a solution to a self-control problem, in which people take steps to increase the likelihood that their relationship will endure. If divorce is difficult, then marriages are more likely to be stable. Marital stability is usually good for children, though children can also benefit from the end of a bad marriage. Marital stability can also be good for spouses, who may benefit from protection against impulsive or destructive decisions that are detrimental both to their relationships and to their long-term welfare. Humans, as opposed to econs, are certainly willing to consider legal protection against impulsive decisions. If econs have impulses, their reflective system keeps them under control. We can even see the legal institution of marriage as a pre-commitment strategy, not unlike that of Ulysses in approaching the Sirens, in which people knowingly choose a legal status that will protect them against their own errors. Some states have in fact experimented with an institution called covenant marriage, which makes exit extremely difficult. People can voluntarily enter into such marriages, just as they can take other steps to protect their long-term interests. But in the modern era, exit is much less rigorously policed. In most states, people can leave the marital form essentially whenever they wish to do so. And it turns out that covenant marriage has made almost no difference to the institution of marriage. Only about 1-3% of couples choose covenant marriage when it is available, and not surprisingly, couples who choose that option tend to be religious and to have a traditional view of marriage, child-rearing, and divorce. By and large, such couples already have the commitments and desires that would tend to produce stable marriages. It is hardly a bad thing that they can choose a form of marriage that fits their goals, and libertarian paternalists are glad that the option is available. But the relative unpopularity of covenant marriage and the evident failure of the movement behind it demonstrates that the non-covenant option is pretty sticky for nearly all couples. Increasingly, marriage is not a particularly extraordinary contract. It is dissoluble at the will of the parties, rather than a permanent status. Now that exit is neither forbidden nor rare, it is hard to contend that the official institution of marriage is essential as a way of promoting the stability of relationships. In any case, the civil union form that we endorse, along with private institutions and their diverse norms, should be able to do the desirable work in promoting such stability. Official marriage licenses also have the unfortunate consequence of dividing the world into the status of those who are married and those who are single in a way that produces serious economic and material disadvantages for the latter, and sometimes for the former. Many of these economic and material inequalities are impossible to defend. For example, is there any good reason that a person in a same-sex relationship should not be able to make medical decisions on his partner's behalf or bequeath some of his assets upon death without paying taxes? Private relationships, intimate and otherwise, might be structured in many different ways, and the simple dichotomy between single and married does not do justice to what people might choose. Indeed, that simple dichotomy is an increasingly imprecise description of what people actually do choose. Many people are in relationships that are intimate, committed, and monogamous, but without the benefits of marriage. Many people are in marriages that are neither intimate nor monogamous. Countless variations exist. Why not leave people's relationships to their own choices, subject to the judgments of private organizations, religious and otherwise? Is official marriage beneficial? Those who want to preserve official marriage, and those who are likely to be alarmed by our proposal, might be concerned with the interests of children or the interests of the more vulnerable partner, usually the woman. These are legitimate concerns. Let us take them up in sequence. Marriage has often been understood as a means of protecting children, and it should be unnecessary to say that this goal is important. But the official institution of marriage is an exceedingly crude tool for providing that protection, which could easily be ensured in better, more direct ways. For example, the law could do much more to ensure that absent parents provide financial help for their children. When a child's interests are involved, mandates are perfectly appropriate. Society can and does go beyond libertarian paternalism to make so-called deadbeat dads pay child support. Those who favor nudges might just add that some simple tools might help. Consider, for example, automatic enrollment, without an opt-out right in this case, of absent parents in a payment plan so that a certain amount is deducted from the relevant checking account on a monthly basis. In any case, there is no reason to think that civil unions and private arrangements, religious and otherwise, cannot provide as much protection of children as official marriage does. If children need material support, that support can be required directly through legal institutions. If children need stable homes, the question is whether an official licensing scheme with the name marriage contributes enough to family stability to be worth the candle. Maybe so, but it's hard to see any basis for a confident answer. If the concern is for dependents at risk after the dissolution of a long-term relationship, good default rules are the best place to start. A detailed literature exists on this question. Some of the most helpful suggestions are both libertarian and paternalist, in a sense that they maintain freedom of choice while also steering people in desirable directions. We shall have more to say on possible approaches shortly. For now, we note only that the official institution of marriage is neither necessary nor sufficient for good default rules. From the standpoint of good choice architecture, then, a central problem with the current licensing scheme is that it is not nearly libertarian enough. Of course, we recognize that no one is forced to marry, certainly not by law. In this way, the institution of marriage is altogether different from the kinds of rigid government commands that most threaten personal freedom. When democratic societies license marriage, they are doing something very different from what they would do by requiring, say, all employers to provide a specified level of health care, or all employees to save a specified amount of money. Marriage might even seem to be a way of facilitating private choices rather than eliminating them. But the licensing scheme is not merely a device for facilitation. It is very different from the law of contract. The state does not simply permit people to marry within their religions. It does not merely enforce people's agreements. It also creates a monopoly on the legal form of marriage, imposes sharp limits on who may enter and how, and accompanies the legal form with material and symbolic benefits that it alone confers. For those who believe in liberty, this is hardly an unambiguous good. We acknowledge that many couples may benefit, in one or another way, from public statements of their commitments to each other. Many people believe that the official institution of marriage helps to secure people's commitments in a way that is both an individual and a social good. But if commitments are important, why not rely on civil unions and private institutions, including religious ones? Is government licensing with the term marriage necessary at all? Many commitments are stable without licenses from the state. People stay tied to their friends, their churches, their co-authors, and their employers for a long time. And even without a government licensing scheme or legal sanction, people take their private commitments seriously. Members of religious organizations, homeowners associations, and country clubs all feel bound, sometimes quite strongly, by the structures and rules of such organizations. Recall that if some kind of commitment is desirable, nothing in our proposal prevents people from making commitments through the civil union form or purely through private institutions. In this light, what is the balance sheet for official marriage? Its benefits are surprisingly low. In many ways, it is an anachronism. The most that can be said is that official marriage might contribute to a kind of commitment that benefits both couples and children. On the cost side, official marriage does not do a great deal of harm. But it does produce unnecessary polarization, confusion about the relationship between state-sponsored marriage and religious marriage, and intense grappling over fundamental issues and definitions. In the current era, the most obvious difficulty is that religious organizations insist that they should be permitted to define marriage as they like, while same-sex couples insist that they should be able to make long-term commitments without having a second-class status as a matter of law. Our proposal simultaneously satisfies both of these opposing factions. The underlying problems would easily be avoided with a simple declaration that marriage should be for private institutions, not for the state, and that religious organizations would be free to set their own rules regarding who could marry. That declaration, a form of separation of church and state, would have an additional benefit, to which we now turn. Nudging couples. In our view, the official institution of marriage and the debate over its nature and future have deflected attention from the key question facing choice architects. What are the appropriate default rules for people who make a commitment to each other? It is here that good choice architects can make real improvements. We cannot sort out all of the complex issues in this space, but let us sketch a few proposals which could be applied to any form of legal domestic partisanship, including marriages in their current form. Our motivation is simple. If we were starting from scratch, no sane person could possibly devise the existing system, which is so full of confusion and arbitrariness that in many states, even experienced divorce lawyers often have no idea how disputes are likely to come out. At a minimum, the choice architecture should be changed so that people can have a clearer sense of their rights and obligations. More ambitiously, nudges should be introduced to protect those who are most vulnerable, frequently women, and above all, children. As usual, the place to start is with people's actual goals and intentions. If people make explicit promises to one another, The law should generally enforce their promises. To the extent that people leave gaps or uncertainties, the law must choose a menu of default rules. Unfortunately, people are likely to need some steering when making long-term mutual commitments. As we have suggested, unrealistic optimism is at its most extreme in the context of marriage. In recent studies, for example, people have been shown to have an accurate sense of the likelihood that other people will get divorced, about 50%. But recall the fact that they have an absurdly optimistic sense of the likelihood that they themselves will get divorced. It's worth repeating the key finding. Nearly 100% of people believe that they are certain or almost certain not to get divorced. It is in these circumstances, and in part for that reason, that people are immensely reluctant to make prenuptial agreements. Believing that divorce is unlikely, and fearing that such agreements will spoil the mood, most people simply take their chances with existing divorce law, which is, not to put too fine a point on it, a mess, often unintelligible even to specialists in the field. Also, it is sophisticated and wealthy couples who are most likely to enter into prenuptial agreements, to understand the law, and to obtain high-quality legal representation in the event of divorce. The result of all this is to leave most people vulnerable to the vagaries of chance, and to a legal system that has an astonishing degree of uncertainty. When prenuptial agreements have not been made, we believe that the relevant rules should nudge the outcome in a way that will help the weakest parties, usually women. Typically, a woman's economic prospects fall after divorce, whereas the prospects of the man increase. It makes sense to adopt default rules that ensure against the most severe kinds of loss. As a presumption, people should be permitted to make their own provisions if that is what they wish to do. If men and women freely agree to an outcome that generally benefits men, the law should respect that agreement and use other parts of the legal system, including the tax and transfer system, to help those who need it. Mandatory rules that forbid people to agree on their preferred terms are not likely to accomplish their intended goals. People will contract around the rules by adjusting other parts of the deal. But what people wish to do is likely to be affected by the law's default rules. If the law establishes a standard practice, many people will follow it. If the default rule says that special help will be provided to those who have been the primary caretakers of the children, then that rule is likely to stick. If joint custody is the clear default rule, when neither parent has been a negligent caretaker, people will have a plain understanding of what will happen on dissolution of the household. And if the default rule says that upon divorce the primary caretaker will continue as such and receive financial assistance, that rule will also tend to stick. In this context, the stickiness of default rules can easily be enlisted to insulate the most vulnerable people from the worst outcomes. Aside from helping the vulnerable, default rules should be clear in this arena, because humans, unlike econs, have a self-serving bias when it comes to negotiating settlements. Essentially, the self-serving bias means that in difficult or important negotiations, we tend to think that both the objectively fair outcome and the most likely outcome is the one that is skewed in our own favor. After the Chicago Bears play the Green Bay Packers, ask both Bears fans and Packers fans in which direction the referees were biased. When both sides suffer from self-serving bias, the bargaining is likely to reach an impasse, and people will spend a lot of time fighting in court, sometimes ruining their lives, at least for a time. In divorce cases, emotions are running high, and each side is likely to think itself entirely in the right, and to assume that the judge will certainly see things the same way. You might think that even if spouses are subject to self-serving bias, lawyers are not, and hence lawyers should be able to deflate their clients' expectations. But in many cases, lawyers suffer from self-serving bias as well. The upshot is that where the law is unclear, long and intense disputes are likely. Both sides would benefit if they could be nudged toward a smaller range of expected outcomes so that their expectations will have some overlap. Families facing divorce will gain if the law provides an anchor or range, helping people know what constitutes a fair or likely outcome. To achieve this goal, the best solution is to introduce something not unlike criminal sentencing guidelines, a fairly narrow range of possible outcomes within which a judge has discretion to consider other factors. In many states, something similar is already in place, But for purposes of the self-serving bias, the rules are less helpful if people do not know about them. And research has shown that many couples entering marriage do not have anything like a clear idea of what generally happens with respect to either child support or alimony payments upon divorce. If you are married, or plan to get married, do you know how alimony and child support are calculated?